Appreciation? What for?
A job well done, said Gascoigne. He returned the letters to the envelope and stood, intending to take John Hinchegarity's letter of authorization to the bank at once. But just as he did so, the foyer door opened, and Alistair Lauderback walked in, shadowed at his heels by Jock and Augustus Smith.
Ah, said Lauderback, perceiving the letter in Gascoigne's hand. I'm just in time, then. Yes, I had a message from Garrity myself this morning. There's been a mix-up, and I'm here to set it straight.
Mr. Lauderback, I presume? Said Gascoigne dryly.
I want a private interview with the magistrate, Lauderback said. It's urgent.
The magistrate is taking his luncheon at present.
Where does he take it?
I'm afraid I don't know, said Gascoigne. The afternoon sessions begin at 2 o'clock. You are welcome to wait until then. Excuse me, gentlemen.
Hold up, said Lauderback, as Gascoigne bowed and made to exit. Where do you think you're going with that letter?
To the bank, said Gascoigne, who could not bear officious rudeness of the kind that Lauderback had just displayed. I have been deputized by Mr. Garrity to facilitate a transaction on his behalf. I beg you to excuse me. Again he made to leave.
Hold up a moment, said Lauderback. Just hold up a moment. It's on account of this very business that I want an audience here. You're not to go off to the bank before I've said my piece.
Gascoigne stared at him coolly. Lauderback seemed to realize that he had begun on the wrong foot, and said,
Hear me out, would you? What's your name?
Gascoigne.
Gascoigne, is it? Yes, I had you for a Frenchman.
Lauderback held out his hand, and Gascoigne shook it.
I'll speak to you, then, Lauderback said, if I can't get the magistrate.
I imagine you would prefer to do so in private, said Gascoigne, still without warmth.
Yes, good.
Lauderback turned to his aides.
You wait here, he said. I'll be 10 minutes.
Gascoigne led him into the magistrate's office and closed the door behind him. They sat down on the Windsor chairs that faced the magistrate's desk.
All right, Mr. Gascoigne, said Lauderback at once, sitting forward. Here's the long and short of it. This whole business is a set-up. I never sold Godspeed to a man named Crosby Wells. I sold it to a man who told me that his name was Francis Wells. But the name was an alias. I didn't know it at the time. Francis Carver, it was him. He took the alias, Francis Wells, and I sold the ship to him, under that name. You see, he kept his Christian name, only the surname changed. The point is this, he signed the deed with a false name, and that's against the law.
Let me see if I understand you correctly, Gascoigne said, pretending to be bemused. Francis Carver claims that a man named Crosby Wells purchased Godspeed, and you claim that this is a lie.
It is a lie, said Lauderback. It's an out-and-out fabrication. I sold the ship to a man named Francis Wells.
Who doesn't exist?
It was an alias, said Lauderback. His real name's Carver, but he told me that his name was Wells.
Francis Wells, Gascoigne pointed out, and Crosby Wells' middle name was Francis. And Crosby Wells does exist, at least he did. So perhaps you were mistaken about the purchaser's identity. The difference between Francis Wells and C. Francis Wells is not very great, I observe.
What's this about a C? Said Lauderback.
I have examined the forwarded copy of the deed of sale, Gascoigne said. It was signed by a C. Francis Wells.
It most certainly was not.
I'm afraid it was, said Gascoigne.
Then it's been doctored, said Lauderback. It's been doctored after the fact.
Gascoigne opened the envelope in his hand and extracted the bill of sale. On first inspection, I believed that it read merely Francis Wells. It was only on leaning closer that I saw the other letter cursively linked to the F. Lauderback looked at it, frowned, and looked closer. And then a deep blush spread across his cheeks and neck.
Cursive or no cursive, he said. C or no C, that deed of sale was signed by the blackguard Francis Carver. I saw him sign it with my own two eyes.
Was the transaction witnessed? Lauderback said nothing. If the transaction was not witnessed, then it will be your word against his, Mr. Lauderback.
It'll be the truth against a lie.
Gascoigne declined to answer this. He returned the contract to the envelope and smoothed it flat over his knee.
It's a set-up, Lauderback said. I'll take him to court. I'll have him flayed.
On what charge?
False pretenses, of course, Lauderback said. Impersonation. Fraud.
I'm afraid that the evidence will bear out against you.
Oh, you're afraid of that, are you?
The law has no grounds to doubt this signature, Gascoigne said, smoothing the envelope a second time, because no other documentation survives Mr. Crosby Wells, official or otherwise, that might serve as proof of his hand.
Lauderback opened his mouth. He seemed about to say something, but then he shut it again, shaking his head.
It was a set-up, he said. It was a set-up all along.
Why do you think Mr. Carver saw the need to take an alias with you?
The politician's answer was surprising.
I've done some digging on Carver, he said. His father was a prominent figure in one of the British merchant trading firms, Dent and Co. You might have heard of him. William Rochfort Carver. No? Well, anyway, sometime in the early 50s, he gives his son a clipper ship, the Palmerston, and the son starts trading Chinese wares back and forth from Canton under the banner of Dent and Co. Carver's still a young man. He's being coddled, really, becoming master of a ship so young. Well, here's what I found out. In the spring of 1854, the Palmerston gets searched when it's leaving the Sydney Harbour. Oh, just a routine job. And Carver's found to be foul of the law on several counts. Evading duty and failing to declare and a pile of other misdemeanours. Each small enough that a judge might turn a blind eye. But the charges come in all at once. When they're stacked up like that, the law has to come down. He's given 10 years at Cockatoo, and that's 10 years of penal servitude, no less. A real dishonour. The father's furious. Revokes the ship, disinherits the son, and as a final touch, makes sure to tarnish his name at every dock and shipyard in the South Pacific. By the time Francis Carver gets out of jail, he has about as good a character as Captain Kidd, in seafaring circles at least. No shipowner's going to lease a ship to him, and no crew's going to take him on.
And so he assumed an alias.
Exactly, said Lauderback, sitting back.
I am curious to know why he only assumed an alias with you, Gascoigne said lightly. He does not seem to have assumed the name Wells in any other context, save for when he purchased this ship. He introduced himself to me, for example, as Mr. Francis Carver.
Lauderback glared at him.
You read the papers, he said. Don't make me spell it out to you. I've made me apology in public. I won't do it again.
Gascoigne inclined his head.
Ah, he said. Carver assumed the alias Francis Wells in order to exploit your former entanglement with Mrs. Wells.
That's it, said Lauderback. He said that he was Crosby's brother. Told me he was settling a score on Crosby's behalf, on account of my having made a bad woman of his wife. It was an intimidation tactic, and it worked.
I see, said Gascoigne, wondering why Lauderback had not explained this so sensibly to Thomas Balfour 2 months ago.
Look, said Lauderback, I'm playing straight with you, Mr. Gascoigne, and I'm telling you that the law is on my side. Carver's break with his father is commonly known. He had 1,000 provocations to assume an alias. Why, I could call in the father's testimony if need be. How would Carver like that?
Not very well, I should imagine.
No, cried Lauderback. Not very well at all.
Gascoigne was annoyed by this. Well, I wish you luck, Mr. Lauderback, in bringing Mr. Carver to justice, he said.
Spare the bromide, Lauderback snapped. Talk to me plain.
As you wish, Gascoigne said, shrugging. You know, without my telling you, that proof of provocation is not evidence. A man cannot be convicted simply because it can be proved that he had a good reason to commit the crime in question.
Lauderback bristled.
Do you doubt my word?
No, indeed, said Gascoigne.
You just think my case is weak. You think I don't have a leg to stand on.
Yes, I think it would be very unwise to take this matter to court, said Gascoigne. "I'm sorry to speak so bluntly. You have my compassion for your troubles, of course."
But Gascoigne felt no compassion whatsoever for Alistair Lauderback. He tended to reserve that emotion for persons less privileged than himself, and although he could acknowledge that Lauderback's current situation was pitiable, he considered the politician's wealth and eminence to be ample consolation for whatever inconveniences the man might be encountering in the short term. In fact, enduring a spot of injustice might do Lauderback a bit of good. It might improve him as a politician, thought Gascoigne, who was, in his private adjudications at least, something of an autocrat.
"I'll wait for the magistrate," said Lauderback. "He'll see sense."
Gascoigne tucked the envelope into his jacket next to his cigarettes.
"I understand that Carver is now attempting to draw down funds from your protection and indemnity scheme in order to finance the debts that he incurred in disposing of the shipwreck."
"That is correct."
"And you wish to refuse him access to this money?"
"Also correct."
"On what grounds?"
Lauderback turned very red.
"On what grounds?" he cried. "The man has stiffed me, Mr. Gascoigne. He was planning this from the outset. You're a fool if you think I'll take it lying down. Is that what you're telling me, to take it lying down?"
"Mr. Lauderback," Gascoigne said, "I do not presume to give you any kind of advice at all. What I am observing is that no laws appear to have been broken. In his letter to Mr. Garrity, Mr. Carver made it very plain that he is acting on Mr. Wells' behalf. For Mr. Wells, as you know, is dead. To all appearances, Carver is merely doing the charitable thing in settling matters as the shipowner's proxy, because the shipowner is not able to do the job himself. I do not see that you have any evidence to disprove this."
"But it's not true!" Lauderback exploded. "Crosby Wells never bought that ship. Francis Carver signed that bloody contract in another man's name. It's a case of forgery, pure and simple."
"I'm afraid that will be very difficult to prove," said Gascoigne.
"Why?"
said Lauderback.
"Because, as I've already told you, there is no proof of Crosby Wells' true signature," said Gascoigne. "There were no papers of any kind in his cottage, and his birth certificate and his miner's right are nowhere to be found."
Lauderback opened his mouth to make a retort, and again seemed to change his mind.
"Oh," said Gascoigne suddenly, "I just thought of something."
"What?"
said Lauderback.
"His marriage certificate," said Gascoigne. "That would bear his signature, would it not?"
"Ah,"
said Lauderback.
"Yes." "But no,"
said Gascoigne, changing his mind.
"It wouldn't be enough. To prove a forgery of a dead man's hand, you would need more than one example of his signature."
"How many would you need?"
said Lauderback. Gascoigne shrugged.
"I am not familiar with the law," he said, "but I would imagine that you would need several examples of his true signature in order to prove the aberrations in the false one."
"Several examples," Lauderback echoed.
"Well," said Gascoigne, rising, "I hope for your sake that you find something, Mr. Lauderback. But in the meantime, I am afraid that I am legally obliged to carry out Mr. Garrity's instruction and take these papers to the bank."
Upon quitting the wayfarer's fortune, the chaplain had not escorted Anna Wetherill directly to the courthouse. He took her instead into the Garrick's Head Hotel, where he ordered one portion of fish pie, the perennial lunchtime special, and one glass of lemon cordial. He directed Anna to be seated, placed the plate of food in front of her, and bid her to eat, which she did obediently and in silence. Once her plate was clean, he pushed the sugared drink across the table towards her and said, "Where is Mr. Stance?" Anna did not seem surprised by the question. She picked up the glass, sipped at it, winced at the sweetness, and then sat for a moment watching him.
"Inland," she said at last. "Somewhere inland. I don't know exactly where."
"North or south of here?"
"I don't know."
"Is he being held against his will?"
"I don't know."
"You do know," said Devlin.
"I don't," Anna said. "I haven't seen him since January, and I've no idea why he vanished like he did. I only know that he's still alive and he's somewhere inland."
"Because you've been getting messages inside your head."
"Messages wasn't the right way to describe it," Anna said. "That wasn't right. It's more like
a feeling. Like when you're trying to remember a dream that you had, and you can remember the shape of it, the sense of it, but no details, nothing sure. And the more you're trying to remember, the more hazy it becomes.
Devlin was frowning. So you have a feeling?
Yes,
Anna said. You have a feeling that Mr. Staines is somewhere in land, and that he's alive?
Yes, said Anna. I can't give you any details. I know it's somewhere muddy, or leafy, somewhere near water. Only it isn't the beach. The water's quick moving, over stones. You see, as soon as I try and put it into words, it trips away from me.
This all sounds very vague, my dear.
It's not vague, Anna said. I'm certain of it. Just as when you're certain you did have a dream, you knew you dreamed, but you can't remember any of the details.
How long have you been having these feelings, these dreams?
Only since I stopped whoring, Anna said. Since my blackout.
Since Staines disappeared, in other words.
The 14th of January, said Anna. That was the date.
Is it always the same? The water, the mud, the same dream?
No.
She did not elaborate, and to prompt her, Devlin said, Well, what else?
Oh, she said, embarrassed. Just sensations, really. Snatches. Impressions.
Impressions of what? She looked away from him.
Impressions of me, she said.
I'm afraid I don't understand you.
She turned her hand over. What he thinks of me, Mr. Staines, I mean, what he dreams about when he imagines me.
You see yourself, but through his eyes.
Yes, Anna said, exactly.
But I do infer that Mr. Staines holds you in high esteem.
He loves me, she said,
and then after a moment she said it again.
He loves me.
Devlin studied her critically. I see, he said. Has he made an avowal of his love?
No, Anna said. He doesn't need to. I know it just the same.
Do you get these feelings frequently?
Very frequently, she said. He thinks of me all the time.
Devlin nodded. The situation was at last becoming clear to him, and with this dawning clarity his heart was sinking in his chest. Are you in love with Mr. Staines, Miss Wetherill?
We spoke of it, she said, the night he vanished. We were talking nonsense, and I said something silly about unrequited love, and he became very serious, and he stopped me, and he said that unrequited love was not possible, that it was not love. He said that love must be freely given and freely taken, such that the lovers in joining make the equal halves of something whole.
A passionate sentiment, Devlin said. This seemed to please her.
Yes, she said.
But he did not declare his love for you after all that.
He didn't make any vows. I said that.
And nor did you.
I never got another chance, she said. That was the night he disappeared.
Carol Devlin sighed. Yes, he understood Anna Wetherill at long last, but it was not a happy understanding. Devlin had known many women of poor prospects and limited means, whose only transport out of the miserable cage of their unhappy circumstance was the flight of the fantastic. Such fantasies were invariably magical. Angelic patronage, invitations into paradise, and Anna's story, touching though it was, showed the same strain of the impossible. Why, it was painfully clear. The most eligible bachelor of Anna's acquaintance possessed a love so deep and pure that all respective differences between them were rendered immaterial. He was not dead, he was only missing. He was sending her messages that proved the depth of his love, and these were the messages that only she could hear. It was a fantasy, Devlin thought. It was a fantasy of the girl's own devising. The boy could only be dead. You want Mr. Staines to love you very much, don't you, Miss Wetherill? Anna seemed offended by his implication.
He does love me.
That wasn't my question.
She squinted at him. Everyone wants to be loved.
That's very true, Devlin said sadly. We all want to be loved.
and need to be loved, I think. Without love, we cannot be ourselves.
You're of a mind with Mr. Staines.
Am I?
Yes, Alice said. That is precisely the sort of thing that he would say.
Your Mr. Staines is quite the philosopher, Miss Wetherill.
Why, Reverend, Alice said, smiling suddenly, I believe you just paid yourself a compliment.
They did not speak for a moment. Anna sipped again at her sugared drink, and Devlin, brooding, looked out across the hotel dining room. After a moment, Anna's hand went to her bosom, where the forged deed of gift still lay against her skin. Devlin looked sharply at her.
You have ample time to reconsider, he said.
I only want a legal opinion.
You have my clerical opinion.
Yes, Anna said. Blessed are the meek.
She seemed to regret this impudence immediately. A violent blush spread across her face and neck, and she turned away. Suddenly, Devlin wanted nothing more to do with her. He pushed his chair back from the table and placed his hands on his knees.
I will accompany you to the courthouse door and no further, he said. What you do with the document in your possession is no longer my business. Know that I will not lie to protect you. I will certainly not lie in a court of law. If anyone asks, I shall not hesitate to tell them the truth, which is that you forged that signature with your own hand.
All right, said Anna, rising. Thank you very much for the pie and the cordial, and thank you for all that you said to Mrs. Wells.
Devlin rose also.
You oughtn't to thank me for that, he said. I let my temper get the better of me there, I'm afraid. I wasn't at my best.
You were marvellous,
Anna said, and she stepped forward and put her hands on his shoulders and kissed him very nicely on the cheek. By the time Anna Wetherill arrived at the Hokitika courthouse, Aubert Gascoigne had already departed for the Reserve Bank, the envelope from John Hincher Garrity snug in the inside pocket of his jacket. Alistair Lauderback had likewise long since left the building. Anna was received by a red-faced solicitor named Fellows, whom she did not know. He directed her into an alcove at the far side of the hall, where they sat down on either side of a plain deal table. Anna handed him the charred document without a word. The lawyer placed it on the table before him, squaring it with the edge of the desk, and then cupped his hands around his eyes to read it.
"Where did you get this?"
Fellows said at last, looking up.
"It was given to me," Anna said. "Anonymously."
"When?"
"This morning."
"Given how?"
"Someone slipped it under the door,"
Anna lied.
"While Mrs. Wells was down here at the courthouse."
"Down here at the courthouse, receiving the news that her appeal has been revoked at last?"
Fellows said with a sceptical emphasis. He turned back to the document.
"Crosby Wells. And Staines is the fellow whom nobody's heard from, and Miss Wetherill is you.
Strange.
Any idea who dropped it off?"
"No."
"Or why?"
"No," Anna said. "I suppose someone wanted to do me a good turn."
"Anyone in mind? Care to speculate?"
"No," Anna said. "I only want to know whether it's good."
"It seems all right," said Fellows, peering at it. "But it's not exactly a cash cheque, is it? Not with things being as they are. 8 weeks on and Mr. Staines still missing."
"I don't understand."
"Well, even if this deed is valid, our good friend Mr. Staines no longer has £2,000 to give away. All of his assets have been seized on account of his absence, effective last Friday. He'd be lucky to scrape together a few hundred from what he's got left."
"But the deed is binding," Anna said. "Even so."
The lawyer shook his head.
"What I'm saying to you, my girl, is that our Mr. Staines can't give you £2,000, unless by some miracle he's found alive with a great deal of cash money on his person. His claims have been given over, bought by other men."
"But the deed is binding," Anna said again. "It has to be."
Mr. Fellows smiled.
"I'm afraid the law doesn't quite work that way. Think on this. I could write you a cheque right now for £1,000,000,
But that doesn't mean you're £1 million up, does it, if I've nothing in my pocket and nobody to act as my surety? Money always has to come out of someone's pocket, and if everyone's pockets are empty, well, that's that, no matter what anyone might claim.
Mr. Staines has £2,000,
Anna said.
Yes, well, if he did, that would be a different story.
No, Anna said. I'm telling you, Mr. Staines has £2,000.
How's that?
The gold in Crosby Wells' cottage belonged to him.
Fellows paused. He stared at her for several seconds, and then in quite a different voice he said, "Can that be proven?"
Anna repeated what Devlin had told her that morning, that the gold was found retorted and bearing a signature that identified the origin of the gold.
"Which mine?"
"I can't remember the name," Anna said.
"What's your source?"
She hesitated. "I'd rather not say."
Fellows was looking interested.
"We could check the truth of it. The fortune was a component part of Wells' estate, after all, so there should be a record somewhere at the bank. I wonder why it hasn't come up before. Someone at the bank is keeping it back, perhaps."
"If it's true," Anna said, "that means the fortune's mine, does it not? £2,000 of it belongs to me, by the authority of this piece of paper here."
"Miss Wetherall," Fellows said, "this kind of money does not change hands so easily. I'm afraid it is never as simple as drawing down a check. But I will say that your coming here today is fortuitously timed. Mrs. Wells' appeal has just been granted, and the share apportioned her is in the process of being released. I can place a hold on her claim very easily while we figure out what to do with this paper of yours."
"Yes," Anna said. "Will you do that?"
"If you will consent to take me on as your solicitor, I will do all that I can to help," Fellows said, sitting back. "My retainer is £2 weekly with expenses. I charge in advance, of course."
She shook her head.
"I can't pay you in advance. I don't have any money."
"Perhaps you might draw down a loan of some kind," Fellows said delicately, shifting his gaze away. "I'm afraid that I'm very strict on all matters of finance. I make no exceptions and take nothing on promise. It's nothing personal. It comes with the training, that's all."
"I can't pay you in advance," Anna said again. "But if you do this for me, I can pay treble your retainer when the money comes in."
"Treble?" Fellows smiled gently. "Legal processes often take a very long time, Miss Wetherall, and sometimes without results. There is no guarantee that the money would come in at all. Miss Wells' appeal took 2 months to verify, and as you've shown very well, that business is not over yet."
"Treble up to a ceiling of £100, Anna said firmly. "But if you clear the funds for me within the fortnight, I'll pay you £200 in cash money."
Fellows raised his eyebrows.
"Dear me," he said, "this is very bold."
"It comes with the training," Anna said. But here Anna Wetherall made a misstep. Mr. Fellows' eyes widened, and he shrank away. Why, she was a whore, he thought. And then it all came back to him. This was the very whore who had tried to end her life in the Canieri Road the very day of Staines' disappearance and Wells' death. Fellows was new to Hokitika. He did not know Anna Wetherall by sight, and had not immediately recognized her name. It was only at her brazen remark that he suddenly knew her. Anna had mistaken his discomfiture for simple hesitation.
"Do you consent to my terms, Mr. Fellows?"
Mr. Fellows looked her up and down.
"I shall inquire at the Reserve Bank about this alleged retortion," he said. His voice was cold. "If the rumour you heard was a good one, then we will draw up a contract. If it was not, then I'm afraid I cannot help you."
"You are very kind," Anna said.
"None of that," said Fellows, roughly. "Where might I find you, say, in 3 hours' time?"
Anna hesitated. She could not return to the wayfarer's fortune that afternoon. She had no money on her person, but perhaps she could ask an old acquaintance to stand her a drink at one of the saloons along Revel Street.
"I'll just come back," she said. "I'll just come back and meet you here."
"As you wish," Fellows said. "Let us err on the side of caution and say 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock,
Anna said.
She held out her hand for the charred document, but Fellows was already opening his wallet to slip the piece of paper inside.
"I think I'll hold on to this," he said, "just for the meantime."
Moon in Aries, crescent, in which Terau Taufari makes a startling discovery. Terau Taufari was feeling very pleased as he leapt from stone to stone through the shallows of the Arahura River, making his way downriver towards the beach. He had spent the past month with a party of surveyors in the Deception Valley, and his purse was full. What's more, that morning he had come upon a marvellous slab of Kahurangi Paunamu, the weight of which was causing his satchel to thump against his back with every step. Back at Mafera, it would be time to dig the crop of Kumara from the ground. Taufari knew it from the appearance of Fanui in the northern sky, the star low on the horizon, dawning well after midnight and setting well before the dawn. His people called this month Pautu Terangi, the post that lifted up the sky, for at nights Te Ikaroa formed a milky arch that ran north to south across the black dome of the heavens. It hung between Fanui in the north and Autahi in the south, and it passed through the red jewel of Rehua directly overhead. For a moment, every night, the sky became a perfect compass, its needle a dusty stripe of stars. At the dawning of Fanui, the crops would be unearthed from the ground. After this was Paenga Fafa, when the tubers would be piled upon the margins of the fields to be classified and counted, and then taken to the store pits and storehouses to be stacked for the winter months ahead. After Paenga Fafa, the year came to an end, or as the Tohunga phrased it, to a death. He rounded a bend in the river, left the shallows, and mounted the bank. Crosby Wells' cottage was looking more forlorn with each passing day. The iron roof had rusted to a flaming orange, and the mortar had turned from white to vivid green. The small garden that Wells had planted had long since gone to seed. Taufari strode up the path, taking sorrowful note of these tokens of decay, and then halted suddenly. There was somebody inside. Slowly, Taufari came closer, peering through the open doorway into the gloom of the interior. The figure in question was curled on the floor, either dead or asleep. He was lying on his hip, with his knees angled close to his chest, and his face turned away from the door. Taufari came closer still. He saw that the man was dressed in a jacket and trousers rather than digger's moleskin, and as Taufari watched, the fabric over his rib moved very slightly, rising and falling with the motion of a breath. Asleep, then. Taufari passed through the doorway, taking care that his shadow did not fall across the man's body and wake him. Moving softly, he edged around the wall behind him to look down upon the sleeper's face. The man was very young. His hair was darkly matted with dirt and grease. The skin of his face seemed almost white by contrast. His face would have been handsome had it not been so plainly ravaged by privation. The lids of his eyes were mottled purple, and there were deep shadows in the hollows beneath them. His breath was fretful and inconstant. Taufari cast his eye over the boy's body. His dress had been worn almost to tatters, and apparently had not been changed in many weeks, for it was thick with mud and dust of all varieties. The coat had once been fine, however, that was plain, and the cravat, stiff with mud, was likewise of a fashionable cut.
"Mr. Staines,"
Taufari whispered. The boy's eyes opened.
"Hello," he said. "Hello there."
"Mr. Staines."
"Yes, that's me,"
the boy said, speaking in a voice that was high and very bright. He lifted his head.
"Excuse me. Excuse me, is this Maori land?"
"No," said Taufari. "How long have you been here?"
"It's not Maori land."
"No."
"I need to be on Maori land,"
the boy said, struggling up into a sitting position. He was holding his left arm oddly across his chest.
"Why?"
Taufari said.
"I buried something," said Staines, "by a tree. But all the trees look the same to me, and I'm afraid I've got myself into a bit of a muddle. Thank heavens you've come along. I'm ever so grateful.
You disappeared, Talfari said.
3 days, perhaps, said the boy, sinking back again. I think it was 3 days ago. I've been mixing up my days. I can't seem to keep them in any sort of order. One forgets to mark the hours when one's alone. I say, will you have a look at this, please?
He pulled down the neck of his shirt, and Taufari saw that the soiled darkness on his cravat was in fact the sticky tar of old blood. There was a wound just above his collarbone, and even from his distance of several feet, Taufari could see that it was a very grave one. It had begun to putrefy. The centre of the wound was black, and fingers of red speared away from it in rays. Taufari could see black speckles of powder burn, dark against the white of his chest, and deduced that it could only be a gunshot wound. Evidently somebody had shot Emery Staines at very close range some time ago.
You need medicine, he said.
Exactly, said Staines. Exactly right. Will you fetch it for me? I'd be most exceedingly obliged. But I'm afraid I don't know your name.
My name is Terau Taufari.
You're a Maori fellow, said Staines, blinking, as though seeing him for the first time.
His eyes crossed and then focused again.
Is this Maori land?
Taufari pointed east.
Up there is Maori land, he said.
Up there?
Staines looked where Taufari pointed.
Why are you down here, then, if your patch is up there?
This is the house of my friend, said Taufari. Crosby Wills.
Crosby? Crosby?
Said Staines, closing his eyes.
He was euchred, wasn't he? Lord, how that man can drink. Hollow legs, both of them. Where is he, then? Gone fossicking?
He's dead, said Taufari.
I'm exceedingly sorry to hear that,
Staines mumbled.
What a terrible blow. And you were his friend. His very good friend. And Anna. You'll accept my condolences, I hope. But I've forgotten your name already.
It's Terau, said Taufari.
So it is, said Staines. So it is.
He paused a moment, wretched with exhaustion, and then said,
You wouldn't mind taking me there, would you, old fellow? You wouldn't mind it.
Where?
To the Maori land, said Staines, closing his eyes again. You see, I've buried a great deal of gold on Maori land, and if you help me, I wouldn't be averse to giving you a pinch of it. I'll stand you whatever you like. Whatever you like. I remember the place exactly. There's a tree. The gold's underneath the tree.
He opened his eyes again and gave Taufari a beseeching, blurry look. Taufari tried again.
Where have you been, Mr. Staines?
I've been looking for my bonanza, said Staines. I know it's on Maori land, but there's nothing to mark Maori land, is there? No kind of fence to mark it. They always said a man could never get lost on the west coast, because there's always mountains on one side and ocean on the other. But I seem to have got myself a little muddled, Terau. It's Terau, isn't it? Yes. Yes, I've been lost.
Taufari came forward and knelt. Up close, the man's wound looked even worse. In the centre of the blackness was a thick crust, showing through it the glint of yellow. He reached out his hand and touched the skin of Staines' cheek, feeling his temperature.
You are sick with fever, he said. This wound is very bad.
Never saw it coming, said Staines, staring at him. Fresh off the boat I was, and green with it. Nothing shows like greenness on a man. Never saw it coming. Heavens, you are a sight for sore eyes. I'm terribly sorry about this muddle. I'm terribly sorry about your mate, Crosby. I really am. What kind of medicine did you say you had about you?
I shall bring it to you, said Taufari. You wait here.
He did not feel hopeful. The boy was not speaking sense, and he was much too sick to walk to Hokitika on his own. He would need to be carried there on a litter or a cart,
and Taofari had seen enough of the Hokitika Hospital to know that men went there to die, not to be cured. The place was canvas-roofed and walled only with the simplest clapboard. The bitter Tasman wind blew through the cracks in the planking, giving rise to a new cacophony of coughing and wheezing with each gust. It stank of filth and disease. There was no fresh water, and no clean linen, and only one ward. The patients were forced to sleep in close quarters with one another, and sometimes even to share a bed.
"Half shares," the boy was saying. "Seemed fair enough to me. Half for you, half for me." "What about it?" he says. "Going mates."
Taofari was calculating the distance in his mind. He could make for Hokitika at a pace, alert Dr. Gillies, hire a cart or a trap of some kind, and be back at the very earliest within 3 hours. But would 3 hours be soon enough? Would the boy survive? Taofari's sister had died of fever, and in her final days she had been very like the way that Staines was now, bright-eyed, both sharp and limp at once, full of nonsense and tumbling words. If he left, he risked the boy's death. But what could he do if he stayed? Suddenly decisive, he bowed his head to say a karakia for the boy's recovery.
"Tutakina ite iwi," he said. "Tutakina ite toto. Tutakina ite iko. Tutakina ite uewa. Tutakina kia u. Tutakina kia mau. Tene tarangi ka tutaki. Tene terangi ka roroku. Tene ta papa ka feuka. E rangi e afitia. E papa e afitia. Nau ka afi. Ka afi."
He raised his head.
"Was that a poem?"
said Staines, staring.
"What does it mean?"
"I asked for your wound to heal," Taofari said. "Now I shall bring medicine."
He took off his satchel, pulled out his flask, and pressed it into the boy's hands.
"Is it the smoke?"
the boy said, shivering slightly. "I've never touched the stuff myself, but how it claws at one, like a thorn in every one of your fingers, and a string around your heart. And one feels it always, nagging, nagging. You'd stand me a mouthful of smoke. I believe you would. You're a decent fella." Taofari shucked his woolen coat and draped it across the boy's legs.
"Just until I find this tree on Maori land," the boy went on, "you can have as many ounces as you please. Only it's the good stuff I'm after. Are you going to the druggist? Pritchard's got my account. Pritchard's all right. Ask him. I've never touched a pipe before."
"This is water," said Taofari, pointing at the flask. "Drink it."
"How extraordinarily kind," said the boy, closing his eyes again.
"You stay here," Taofari said firmly.
He stood.
"I go to Hokitika and tell others where you are. I shall come back very soon."
"Just a bit of the good stuff," said Staines,
as Taofari left the cottage. His eyes were still closed.
"And after you come back, we'll go and have a nose around for all that gold. Or we'll start with the smoke, yes, do it properly. What an unrequited love it is, this thirst. But is it love when it is unrequited? Good Lord. Medicine," he says. "And him a Maori fellow."
Mars in Aquarius, in which Sukyong Sheng pays a call upon a very old acquaintance, and Francis Carver dispenses some advice. Sukyong Sheng, after making his £5 purchase at Brunton, Solomon and Barnes that morning, had immediately gone into hiding. The shopkeeper who loaded the pistol had been very plainly suspicious of his intentions, though he had accepted Ah Suk's paper note without complaint. He had followed Ah Suk to the door of his establishment to see him off, and Ah Suk twice looked over his shoulder to see him standing, arms folded, scowling after him. A Chinaman purchasing a revolver with cash money, laying down that cash money all at once, refusing to pay more than £5 even for the item, and requesting that the piece be loaded in the store. This was not the kind of suspicion that one kept to oneself. Ah Suk knew very well that by the time he reached the corner of Weld and Tancred Streets, the rumour mill would have begun to turn, and swiftly. he needed to find a place to hide until sundown, whereupon he would venture, under the cover of darkness, to the rearmost bedroom on the ground floor of the Crown Hotel. There was no one in Hokitika Arsuk trusted enough to ask for aid. Certainly not Anna, not any more, nor Mannering, nor Pritchard. He was not on speaking terms with any of the other men from the council at the Crown, except Arqui, who, of course, would be in Kanyere digging the ground. For a moment, he considered taking a room at one of the more disreputable hotels on the eastern side of town, perhaps even paying for the week in advance to disguise his motivation. But even there, he could not guarantee anonymity. He could not guarantee that the proprietors would not talk. His presence in Hokitika on a Monday morning was conspicuous enough, even without wagging tongues. Better not to trust in the discretion of other men, he thought. He resolved instead to take his pistol into the alley that ran in parallel between Revel Street and Tancred Street. The alley formed a rutted thoroughfare between the rear allotments of the Revel Street warehouses and hotels, which faced west, and the rear allotments of the Tancred Street cabins, which faced east. There was ample opportunity for camouflage, and the alley was central enough to allow points of entry and exit from all sides. Best of all, the space was frequented only intermittently by the tradesmen and penny postmen who serviced the hotels. In the allotment behind a wine and spirit merchant's, Arsuk found a place to hide. A piece of corrugated iron had been propped against an outhouse, creating a kind of lean-to, open at both ends. It was shielded from the alley by a large flax bush, and from the rear of the merchant warehouse by the outhouse pump. Arsuk crawled into the triangular space and sat down cross-legged. He was still sitting in this way 3 hours later when Mr. Everard came running down Revel Street, shouting the news to the bellman that George Shepherd had taken out a warrant for a Chinaman's arrest. At Mr. Everard's words, a thrill ran through Arsuk's body. Now he could be certain that Francis Carver had been forewarned. But Arsuk had an advantage Carver did not, could not, suspect. Thanks to Walter Moody's confidence, he knew exactly where to find Carver and when. Warrant or no warrant, George Shepherd had not arrested him yet. Arsuk listened until the cry up and down Revel Street had faded, and then, smiling slightly, he closed his eyes.
"What are you doing down there?"
Arsuk started. Standing over him, his hand on the outhouse door, was a dirty youth of perhaps 25, wearing a sack coat and a collarless shirt.
"You're not allowed to squat here, you know," the youth said, frowning. "This is private land. It belongs to Mr. Chesney. You can't just hole up where you please."
Another voice from the warehouse.
"Who's that you're talking to, Ed?" "There's a chink just sitting here, beside the outhouse."
"A what?"
"A Chinaman. He's using the outhouse."
"No,"
called the youth.
"He's just sitting beside it."
"Well, tell him to get a move on."
"Get on with you,"
said the youth, giving Arsuk a gentle nudge with the toe of his boot.
"Get on with you. You can't stay here."
The voice from the warehouse called again.
"What did you say he was doing there, Ed?"
"Nothing,"
the youth called back.
"Just sitting. He's got a pistol."
"A what?"
"He's got a pistol, I said."
"What's he doing with it?"
"Nothing. He's not making any trouble as far as I can see."
A pause, then.
"Is he gone?"
"Get on with you,"
Ed said again to Arsuk, motioning.
"Go on."
Roused to motion at last, Arsuk slipped out from beneath the corrugated iron and hurried away, feeling the puzzled eyes of the youth on his back as he did so. He ducked behind a laundry line and into the oaty-smelling stables at the rear of the Hotel Imperial, keeping his head down and his pistol clasped tight to his chest. Above the wickering and stamping of the horses, he could hear that the two men were still calling back and forth, discussing him. He knew that before long he would be pursued. He needed to hide himself, and quickly, before someone sounded the alarm. Arsuk ran to the end of the stalls and peered over the half-door. He looked along the row of allotments, at the lean-to kitchens beyond them, the baize doors for the tradesmen, the privies, the pits for waste. Where would he be safest? His gaze came to rest upon the small cluster of buildings that formed the police camp, and among them the wooden cottage in which George Shepherd lived. His heart gave a sudden lurch. Well, why not, he thought, suddenly bold. It is the last place in Hokitika that anyone would think to find me. He crossed the small track between the stables and the police camp fence, walked up to George Shepherd's kitchen door, and rapped smartly upon it. While he was waiting for a response, he looked furtively about him, but the alley was quite empty, and there was nobody in the yards on either side of where he stood. Unless someone was watching him from inside one of the hotels, which was very possible, the cockled glass shielding all view of the interior, then nobody could see him, standing in the shadow of George Shepherd's lean-to, pistol in hand.
"Who is it?"
came a woman's voice through the door.
"Who is it?"
"For Margaret," said Suk Yong Sheng, leaning his mouth close to the wood.
"Who?"
"For Margaret Shepherd."
"But who is it? Who's calling?"
It seemed to him that her mouth was very close to the wood also. Perhaps she was leaning close on the other side.
"Suk Yong Sheng,"
he said. And then, into the ensuing silence,
"Please."
The door opened, and there she was.
"Margaret,"
said Ah Suk, full of feeling. He bowed. Only when he rose from the bow did he allow himself to appraise her. Like Lydia Wells, she too seemed virtually unaltered since the scene of their last encounter at the courthouse in Sydney, when she stepped forward with the testimony, the false testimony, that had saved his life. Her hair now showed a strip of silver down the central part, and it had turned brittle, such that the few wisps that had escaped her hairnet formed a haze about her head. Apart from this small token of her advancing age, her features seemed more or less the same. The same frightened, watery eyes, the same buck teeth, the same broken nose broad across the bridge, the same blurred lips, the same look of fearful shock and apprehension. How well the memory is stirred by the sight of a familiar face! All in a rush, Ah Suk could see her sitting down in the witness chair, folding her gloved hands neatly in her lap, blinking at the prosecutor, coughing twice into a scrap of lawn, tucking it into the cuff of her dress, folding her hands again, telling a lie to save his life. She was staring at him. Then she hissed,
"What on earth?"
and gave a laugh that was almost a hiccup.
"Mr. Suk, what on earth? There is a warrant out for your arrest. Did you know that? George has taken out a warrant."
"May I come in?"
said Ah Suk. He was holding the pistol against his hip, with his body half turned to shield it. She had not seen it yet. A gust of wind blew through the open door as he spoke, causing the interior walls of the cottage to shudder and thrum. The wind moved visibly over the stretched calico.
"Quickly," she said. "Quickly now."
She hustled him into the cottage and shut the door.
"Why have you come?"
she whispered.
"You are a very kind woman, Margaret."
Her face crumpled.
"No,"
she said.
"No."
Ah Suk nodded.
"You are very kind."
"It's a terrible position you're putting me in,"
she whispered.
"What's to say I won't send word to George? I ought to. There's a warrant out. And I had no idea, Mr. Suk. I had no idea you were even here before this morning. Why have you come?"
Ah Suk, moving slowly, brought out the pistol from behind his back. She brought her hand up to her mouth.
"You will hide me," he said.
"I can't,"
said Mrs. Shepherd, still with her hand over her mouth. She stared at the revolver.
"You don't know what you're asking, Mr. Suk."
"You will hide me until dark,"
Ah Suk said.
"Please."
She worked her mouth a little, as though gnawing on her palm, and then snatched her hand away and said,
"Where will you go when it gets dark?"
"Take Carver's life,"
said Ah Suk.
"Carver?"
She groaned and moved on quick feet away from him, flapping her hand, as though motioning him to put the gun away out of sight. Ah Suk did not move.
"Please, Margaret."
"I never dreamt I'd see you again," she said. "I never dreamt—"
She was interrupted. There came a smart rap on the door, the front door this time, on the far side of the cottage. Margaret Shepherd's breath caught in her throat. For an instant, Ah Suk feared that she was going to vomit. Then she flew at him, pushing his chest with both hands.
"Go,"
she whispered, frantic.
"Into the bedroom. Get under the bed. Get out of sight. Go, go, go!"
She pushed him into the bedroom that she shared with the jailer. It was very tidily kept, with two chests of drawers, an iron-framed bed, and a single embroidered tract stapled to the framing above the headboard. Ah Suk did not have time to look around him. He fell to his knees and slithered under the bed, still with the pistol in his hand. The door closed. The room darkened. Ah Suk heard steps in the passage, and then the sound of the latch being lifted. He turned to the side. Through the calico wall beside him, a square of lightness widened, and a patch of blackness stepped forward into it, clouding the centre. Ah Suk felt the sudden chill of the wind.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Shepherd. I'm looking for your husband. Is he at home?"
Ah Suk stiffened. He knew that voice. Margaret Shepherd must have shaken her head, for Francis Carver said,
"Care to tell me where he might be found?"
"Up at the construction site, sir."
She spoke barely above a whisper.
"Up at Seaview, is he?"
"Yes, sir."
Ah Suk cradled the Kerr patent in both hands. There would be nothing easier than to slither out from beneath the bed and stand and press the muzzle to the wall. The cartridge would rip through the calico walls like nothing. But how could he be sure not to injure Mrs. Shepherd? He looked at the patch of darkness, trying to see where Carver's shadow ended and Mrs. Shepherd's began.
"The alert's gone up," Carver was saying. "Shepherd's just put in for a warrant. Our old friend Suk's in town. Armed and on the loose."
The jailer's wife said nothing. In the bedroom, Ah Suk began to ease himself out from under the bed.
"It's me he's after," Carver said.
No answer. Perhaps she only nodded.
"Well, your husband's done me a good turn in sounding the warning," Carver went on. "You let him know that I appreciate it."
"I will."
Carver seemed to linger.
"Rumour has it that he's been in Hokitika since late last year," he said. "Our mutual friend. You must have seen him."
"No,"
she whispered.
"You never saw him? Or you never knew?"
"I never knew," she said. Not until this morning."
In the bedroom, still with the pistol trained on the calico shadow, Ah Suk got to his knees and then to his feet. He began to move towards the wall. If he angled the pistol sideways, if he shot obliquely rather than head-on...
"Well, George did," Carver was saying. "He's known for a while now. Been keeping a watch upon the man." "He didn't tell you?"
"No,"
whispered Mrs. George. Another pause.
"I suppose that figures," Carver said.
Ah Suk had reached the timber frame of the bedroom doorway. He was perhaps 6 feet away from the square of lightness that was the front door. The doubled sheet of calico was all that stood between him and Francis Carver. Was Carver armed? There was no way to tell, short of opening the door and confronting him face to face. But if he did so, he would lose precious seconds, and he would lose the advantage of surprise. And yet he still did not dare shoot for fear of hurting Mrs. Shepherd. He peered at the shapes on the fabric, trying to see where the woman was standing. Did the door open to the left or to the right? The blackness of the calico shadow seemed to thicken slightly.
"You've spent your lifetime paying for it," Carver said. "Haven't you?"
Silence.
"And it's never enough."
Silence.
"He doesn't want your penance," Carver said. "Mark my words, Mrs. Shepherd. Your penance is not what he wants. He wants something that he can take for his very own. George Shepherd wants revenge."
Mrs. Shepherd spoke at last.
"George abhors the notion of revenge," she said. "He calls it brutish. He says revenge is an act of jealousy, not of justice."
"He's right," Carver said. "But everyone's jealous of something."
The patch of blackness in the doorway faded and dissolved, and Ah Suk heard Carver's footsteps retreating. The cottage door closed, and there came a rattling sound as Mrs. Shepherd drew the bolt and chain. Then lighter footsteps approaching, and the bedroom door opened. Mrs. Shepherd looked at Arsuk, startled, and then at the pistol in his hand.
"You fool," she said, "in broad daylight, and with the sergeant 5 paces away."
Arsuk said nothing. Again Mrs. George seemed to hiccup. Her voice rose to a pitch that was partly a whisper, partly a shriek.
"Are you in your right mind? What do you think would happen to me, if you took that man's life on my doorstep? How could... do you think, with the duty sergeant 5 paces away, without a... and George, what on earth?"
Arsuk felt ashamed.
"Sorry," he said, letting his hands fall.
"I'd be hanged," said Margaret Shepherd. "I'd be hanged. George would see to it."
"No harm done," said Arsuk.
The woman's hysteria melted into bitterness at once.
"No harm done," she said.
"Very sorry, Margaret."
And he did feel sorry. Perhaps he had lost his chance. Perhaps now she would turn him out into the street, or ring for her husband, or summon the sergeant, and he would be captured, and Carver would walk free. She stepped forward and eased the revolver from his hand. She held it only a moment before setting it to the sides, carefully upon the whatnot, making sure the muzzle was turned away. Then she hovered a moment, not looking at him. She breathed several times, deeply. He waited.
"You'll stay here till after dark," she said at last, and quietly.
Still she did not look at him.
"You'll stay under the bed until it's dark, and it's safe to leave."
"Margaret," said Arsuk.
"What?"
she whispered, shrinking away, darting a quick look at the lamp fixture, then at the headboard of the bed.
"What?"
"Thank you," said Arsuk.
She peered at him, and then quickly dropped her gaze to his chest and stomach.
"You stand out a mile in that tunic," she mumbled. "You're a Chinaman through and through. Wait here."
In 10 minutes she was back with a jacket and trousers over her arm and a soft-crowned hat in her hand.
"Try these on," she said. "I'll sew the trousers up for size, and you can borrow a jacket from the jailhouse. You'll leave this place looking like an Englishman, Mr. Suk, or you won't leave it at all."
Ah, Potiki Arahua, The Children of Antares, in which Mr. Staines takes his medicine and Miss Wetherill takes a fall. Te Rau Taufare reached Pritchard's drug hall by 3:30. By the stroke of 4, he and Pritchard were sitting in a rented trap, driving a pair of horses northward as fast as the trap would allow. Pritchard was half-standing, bareheaded, reckless, whipping the horses into a froth. There was a bulge in his jacket pocket. A glass jar of laudanum sloshing thickly, so that the rusty liquid left an oily wash of colour on the inside of the glass that thinned and then thickened each time the wheels of the trap went over a stone. Taufare was gripping the seat back with both hands, doing his best not to be sick. "And it was me he said he wanted," Pritchard said to himself, exhilarated. "Not the doctor, me." Charlie Frost, queried by the lawyer fellows, told the truth. Yes, the fortune found on Crosby Wells' estate had been found already retorted. The smelting was the work of the Chinese goldsmith, Kui Long, who until that morning had been the sole digger employed to work Mr. Staines' gold mine, the Aurora. Mr. Fellows wrote this down in his pocketbook and thanked the young banker very courteously for his help. Then he produced the charred deed of gift that Anna Wetherill had given him and handed it wordlessly across the desk. Frost, glancing at it, was astonished.
"It's been signed," he said.
"Come again," said Fellows.
"Emery Staines has signed this document sometime in the past 2 months," said Frost firmly. "Unless that signature is a fake, of course. But I know the man's hand. That's his mark. The last time I saw this piece of paper, there was a space next to this man's name. No signature."
"Then he's alive," said the lawyer.
Benjamin Löwenthal, turning into Collingwood Street, was surprised to find that Pritchard's drug hall was shut and locked, with a card in the window saying the establishment was closed.
He walked around to the rear of the building, where he found Pritchard's assistant, a boy named Giles, reading a paper on the back stoop.
"Where's Mr. Pritchard?" he said.
"Out," said the boy.
"What is it that you're wanting?"
"Liver pills."
"Repeat prescription?"
"Yes."
"I can sort you. Come on in the back way."
The boy put aside his paper, and Löwenthal followed him inside, through Pritchard's laboratory, into the shop.
"It's not like Joe to leave his office on a Monday afternoon," Löwenthal said, while the boy set about making up his order.
"He went off with a native fellow."
"Taufare?"
"Don't know his name," the boy said. "He came by all in a bother, not 2 hours ago. Gave his message to Mr. Pritchard, and then Mr. Pritchard packed me off to rent a trap for the both of them. And then they tore off to the Arahura like a pair of night riders."
"Indeed." Löwenthal was curious. "You didn't find out why?"
"No," the boy said. "But Mr. Pritchard took along a whole jar of laudanum and a pocket full of powder besides. The native man said he needs medicine. I heard him say it, but he didn't say whom. And Mr. Pritchard kept saying something I didn't understand at all."
"What was that?" said Löwenthal.
"The horse bullet," said the boy. "Why, Anna Wetherill!"
Clinch's tone was less astonishment than shock.
"Hello, Edgar."
"But what are you doing here? Of course, you are most welcome. But what are you doing?"
He came out from behind the desk.
"I need a place to be," she said, "until 5 o'clock. May I trespass upon your hospitality for a few hours?"
"Trespass? There's no trespassing,"
Clinch cried, coming forward to take her hands in his.
"Why, yes, of course, of course. You must come into my office. Shall we take tea with biscuits? How good it is to see you. How very lovely. Where is your mistress? And where are you going at 5 o'clock?
"I've an appointment at the courthouse,"
said Anna Wetherill, politely disengaging her hands and stepping back from him. Clinch's smile vanished at once.
"Have you been summoned?"
he said anxiously.
"Are you to be tried?"
"It's nothing like that. I've engaged a solicitor, that's all. Of my own volition."
"A solicitor?"
"Yes," Anna said. "I'm going to contest the widow's claim."
Clinch was astonished.
"Well,"
he said, smiling again to cover his bewilderment.
"Well, you must tell me all about it, Anna, and we must take tea together.